Cthulhu in the Deep South by Kirk Battle, read by R. Alex Murray. Chapter 1. Every stray sound on the wind, every dog bark, and every suspicious look from another reminds me that they're coming. Most people will think me mad for what I'm about to write. Perhaps by explaining my story from the beginning, others will believe me and what happened on that terrible island off the coast of South Carolina. It was 1837 then, and my mother and father were very proud when I attended Miskatonic University. Yet I had misgivings about the academic life they sought for me. 2 years of my youth were spent at Miskatonic, reading and studying in a mixed course of anthropology and archaeology. After countless hours studying and reciting the old myths of uncivilized people, I came to the conclusion that I could not find any happiness in a life of books. I longed instead for adventure, to see the world, discover something wondrous and new. Such youthful folly. How I wish I had taken those legends more seriously. I decided to take a respite from my studies and go on a voyage. Nothing spectacular or dangerous. I only wanted to try the seagoing life for a season. I discussed the matter with my parents. They grudgingly admitted that perhaps a few months working on a merchant ship would do me some benefit. In those days, the frozen water trade was still a growing affair. Frederick Tudor, the founder of the business, had developed an ingenious method of insulation and water management that allowed the ice to be carried as far as Calcutta, or so he claimed. In April, arrangements were made with the esteemed ice merchant so that I might sail on one of his ships. It had been a weak winter, and the ice harvest was poor in the lakes and rivers of Massachusetts. The ship was to locate a glacier in the northern seas, harvest ice until the hold was full, and then head for Charleston, Savannah, and eventually New Orleans. Then we would return north and conclude my journey. The South was a controversial place to me in those days. I'd read long, luxurious descriptions of the beautiful white plantations with their pillared porticos and green fields of rice and cotton that stretched out for miles. Both of my parents were ardent abolitionists, and claimed that life on the actual plantations was far different from the few slaves I saw in my home of Arkham. The only slaves I'd ever seen were visiting the North with their masters. They admonished me to carefully observe the brutalities of that curious institution. Back then, slavery was like a mythological beast to me, dire, yet not entirely real. Did not understand even a tenth of its cruelties, as I do now. When I arrived at the ship with my bag, a group of people lounged on the deck. There were the usual officers and white men, but a portion of the crew were also Negroes. The officers and white men ignored me, so I had no choice but to approach this latter group. After introducing myself, they looked at me suspiciously. One of them, Sam, took a liking to me after I stumbled over how to address his nautical band, since they were both my senior and yet could not properly be addressed as Mr. He showed me the sleeping quarters and explained the basics of ship life to me. Sam promised to show me the proper knots and more complex tasks once the voyage was underway. The ship was soon put in order by the captain, a man named Randolph Johnson. The crew only called him Captain, the rest being too much to bother with when orders need to be shouted on the high seas. I can still remember my thrill as the ship lurched away from the docks and we left the harbor. The seas churned and the salt air was a soothing chill on my face. I was leaving Massachusetts for the first time in my life. I would never return. My first task was cutting huge bales of straw, spreading them around the ship's hold. This would create the insulation layer for the ice and was dull, monotonous work. Mr. Tudor's preservation system would require the ship to daily pump out bilge water, presumably from the melting ice, but also because of his curious theory that it was contact with the water that made ice melt. The captain said it was nonsense, but our shipping contract had very strict conditions about how the ice should be handled. All the captain cared about was using the ice as ballast for the trip south, where he would load up on cotton and other fine goods. We were to head far north in the direction of Baffin Bay, sailing until we came across an iceberg broken off from one of the great icy sheets of the Arctic. We sailed 3 days, each day the wind growing colder and howling more dreadfully in my ear. Soon I became accustomed to the cold, could stand in the worst gale with barely a shiver. The other sailors called it the blood thickening. the process by which one's body adapted to the harsh temperatures of the Arctic. I only know that my teeth stopped chattering and my hands quit shaking quite so fiercely. Work was divided among the crew by the captain, and he inevitably assigned the most dangerous tasks to the Negroes. They were often ordered high up in the ship's masts, tying the rigging and handling the sails. The tall, lonely lookout spot perched on the worst of the frigid winds was their burden. They would build a light charcoal fire in the evenings, below decks, when there was a spare moment. I would sometimes stop by to warm my hands by the fire, speak with Sam. He told me that he was originally from Georgia. It was a warm, beautiful place, but dangerous for him and his people. Even though he was free, legally free, by proper court record, he had no rights in the South. He recounted tales of grisly kidnappings where whites would simply snatch an unwary man and claim he was their slave. Since the Negro could not testify in court, he had no redress or way to prove his freedom. He asked if I would act as a white patron for him, should that happen. I promised Sam I would speak for him, and he thanked me. We began to pass tiny chunks of floating ice, but nothing of the size that was necessary. Then on the sixth day, we came upon it. An iceberg so big the ship's lookout shouted, "Land ho!" It loomed menacingly, breaking the horizon with its icy blue peak like some horrible bruise on the sky. It looked as if the claws of some terrible creature had reached out of the sea toward the sun before being frozen in place. By the glances and murmurs of the crew, I knew everyone on the ship felt trepidation as soon as they laid eyes on it. When the captain first saw the towering iceberg, he became confused. It was certain he had led us off course, for it was far too large for the region. It should have melted to a much smaller size at this latitude. Yet, despite checking and rechecking the logbooks, there was no denying the monstrous iceberg right in front of us. The captain decided to count the discovery as a good fortune and be grateful for the week of sailing this would spare us. We pulled close to the frozen peak and made ready to begin the ice harvest. The mountain of ice possessed no natural cove. We could find no melt points, no ice chutes, nothing that we might use to make our way to the top of the iceberg's craggy plain. The captain had no choice but to order us to take out the ice axes and crampons, then select a group to climb the frozen anomaly. Volunteers were asked for, and none came forward. Then the captain simply ordered the Negroes to do it. I saw the worried look on Sam's face, felt the situation most unfair, so I complained aloud that the captain should have us draw straws. The captain sneered, ordered me to climb the iceberg with them. Sam shook his head when I sought to protest further. Standing in a small group while the rest of the crew grappled the ship onto the iceberg, Sam offered to ascend the craggy ice wall first. His job would be to hammer in the nails and rope that each climber would rely on afterward. He told me to take heart, as he saw me staring wide-eyed at the looming Arctic barrier. We made ready for our ascent. Sam had to be thrown over the side, landing on a tiny shelf selected as the best available starting point. The biggest danger expected was for the ice to come loose as he climbed. Below him was the cold blue Arctic sea, little chance of rescue before hypothermia took him. Yet, as Sam clambered up, he exclaimed that the stuff was so frozen it might as well be rock. He made steady work of it as he hammered pegs and strung rope while ascending to the top. It was then that a queer feeling of discomfort at our circumstances began to overcome me. It was already strange for this iceberg to be so far south. But for it to not have thawed at all? Simply impossible. Soon Sam worked his way up the cliff, which was easily 100 yards above the ship. Several more Negroes climbed up using the line, and then it was my turn. It was fearful work. By now, I imagined that the nail and ropes might have come loose, and I stood a good chance of falling to my death. I could not decide which would be worse, hitting the ship or falling into the icy wastes below. Yet it proved true to Sam's word. The iceberg was so frozen it was practically made of stone. I pulled my way up, and eventually managed to clamber over the ledge. The shelf of the iceberg took my breath away. I saw a dead, empty landscape of glistening white and blue. This stretched out before me until it became the mighty peak of ice. A cold blue mist pervaded this whole plain, making my face burn. My lungs ached as I breathed. No life could exist on this horrible structure. Once everyone made the climb, our task was to begin drilling. The plan was that we would place several blasting caps around the shelf, light a lengthy fuse, and then make a hasty retreat to the boat. As we drilled, all of us continued to marvel at the density of the ice, for no cracks or disruptions seemed to come from the work. It could be drilled as smoothly as if it were mortar. Four holes were drilled in a semicircle around the ledge, and packed with enough blasting powder to ensure we knocked loose more than enough ice for our voyage south. A good 30-minute fuse was applied to each one, and we lit them simultaneously. The descent was fast indeed, and we were back on the ship and a safe distance away before 20 minutes had passed. By now, the crew's discomfort at the strange glacier had given way to the promise of money. Whatever curious properties this ice possessed, less sailing meant more profit from the contract. Perhaps there would be extra time in the steamy southern ports with all of their accompanying pleasures. Yet the longer I stared at the towering mountain of ice, waiting for the explosion over the howling wind, the more I felt uneasy. The blasts of the powder rang out with a deafening explosion. Many of the men ducked their heads as enormous chunks of ice flew into the air. The glacier shuddered, and then the blasted section began to cascade down in great heaping blocks. The crew cheered and clapped. A few hands pounded me on the back, and I saw the captain smile. Our pleasure disappeared when a sound like claws across a chalkboard pierced the air. Many of us had to cover our ears. The screeching, tearing sound ripped the air as the entire mountain of ice cascaded into the sea. It went on for what seemed like an eternity. All the crew transfixed as we watched the glacier collapse before us. When it was finally over, I found my fingers had dug into the railing of the ship and throbbed from the exertion. Some of the crew murmured prayers, while others asked if anyone else had seen it. Had anyone seen that the collapsing structure had not been solid at all, but hollow? In the great splashing waves, the original state of the glacier was impossible to make out for certain. And despite all I know now, I did not see this myself in the chaos of the collapse. The captain took more than a few moments to recover his composure before he silenced the crew. There was more ice than the ship could ever need for the harvest now. He ordered the hooks ready and the boats to be lowered. The ice harvest commenced. Before the rowboats could be set out, the Negroes formed themselves into a party and Sam led them to the captain. I only heard a little bit of their conversation, but it gave voice to the dread that must have lurked in all our minds. They wanted us to leave at once. Just keep going north. Find a different iceberg. One claimed he had a strange feeling, and he was certain the iceberg was cursed. Sam, more articulate than the others, wondered if there might be something poisonous in the ice that would make anyone who used it ill. Some of the crew muttered that maybe they were right. Others said it was just heathen nonsense. The captain would have none of it. He boxed Sam behind the ears and threatened to throw them all into the slave markets in Charleston if they didn't obey. Their fear of slavery was greater than any unease at the strange ice. The boats were lowered, and we set out to collect our cargo. I rode into the shattered remains of the frozen mountain reluctantly. Only a few dozen feet away from the ship, an eerie silence possessed the place, and the same chilly mist from before floated about the air. The blue chunks of glacier seemed to loom around us like a cemetery of headstones to watery monstrosities. There was only the occasional noise from the others as the crew worked, hooking and loading ice into the rowboats. The pieces were quite large, yet surprisingly light for ice, and horrifically cold, so that it burned if it touched bare skin. We worked quickly and methodically, loading the rowboats, then returning to the ship, then heading back out. So it went, for hours. It was near the end of the day. The little rowboat was noticeably lower in the sea from the weight of the ice. The blue mist still lingered and made my very bones ache from the ceaseless chill. I'm not even sure why we kept pressing on for more. As we got farther away, a feeling of oppression came over me. One of the crew gasped, lifted his oar out of the water, pointing down. The ripples from his oar stroke were flowing back into themselves. At the time, I thought I was exhausted from work. We all agreed this would be our last trip. We continued until we came to a long piece of dismembered glacier. No communication passed between us and the boat. Without a word, we hooked and pulled and hauled the ice on board. We turned back to the ship. This newest piece of ice held my attention. Below the distorted surface, I could discern some sort of object. At times, I could see it clearly, yet when I tilted my head and perceived it from a different angle, the thing seemed to vanish. It was the size of a man's fist. It gave me an eerie feeling. I felt outside my own body, limbs moving in response to some autonomic command uttered long ago. Did not say a word of this to anyone. I'd learned my lesson about speaking out after trying to help Sam. My hope was that someone else would notice it, but no one did. The ice block was hoisted up with the rest of the cargo, and the idea was dismissed as a figment of imagination. The ship's hold was laid out in a neat cobblestone framework of ice with straw packed between each layer. We filled the entire ship's hold this way, but I kept pushing that one strange chunk toward the side of the ship. Perhaps we would not need it. For reasons I cannot put into words, I knew with certainty if the strange piece of ice was loaded into the hold, it would mean our doom. The ship steadily filled with cargo, but as the last of the straw was spread, the captain himself walked straight to the cursed piece. He hooked it, dragged it over to the hold, throwing it on top of the pile. Then he closed the hatch and fastened the door with chains. He clasped a padlock about the door and hung the iron key around his neck. Whatever I had seen was now locked below the ship, and I knew with certainty it should not be. We set sail for the deep south.